Elton John and Leon Russell have a new album together called The Union. In some ways, it is Elton John, the outrageous superstar with so many major songs, from Your Song and Philadelphia Freedom through Candle in the Wind and The Bitch Is Back, acknowledging his debt to Leon Russell, the Oklahoma-raised piano-playing songwriter probably best known for writing the song Superstar and many hits for Joe Cocker, who he toured with on the infamous Mad Dogs and Englishmen tour. Elton inducted Leon into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in mid-March of this year, and Leon also had brain surgery shortly before recording the new disc, The Union. The Cafe's Michaela Majune sat down with Elton and Leon and began by asking Elton John how the two of them met.
Basically, I did a program called Spectacle, which I produced with my partner David Furnish and some other people, and it was 2008. And November, and I did the very first program. And Elvis Costello, who was the host of the program, asked me to choose three singer-songwriters that I thought had been forgotten about. So I chose David Ackles, Laura Nero, and Leon. And I played, we saw some footage of Leon on the show. We talked about him, and I made up a faux kind of Leon Russell song at the end. And my partner, David Furnish, had never really heard of either any of them because he's quite young. Well, younger than me. And he went about and bought all the CDs and put them on his iPod. And 2009, January, we were in Africa. And I was getting ready to go to lunch. And I was shaving. And I asked David to put some music on his iPod. And I'm a Luddite. So I didn't know how to work an iPod. And he said, look, these are the artists. You pick one. I went, oh, Leon Russell, let's have Leon. So I'm shaving. And suddenly I'm electric shaving. And I suddenly burst into tears because I was listening to all these wonderful songs that took me back to the early 70s, late 60s, when, you know, Leon was the person that I idolized when I first heard him play with Delaney and Bonnie, not realizing I'd heard him play on many, many records before that. I wanted to play like him, and then when he did Joe Cocker and Mad Dogs and Englishmen, I went to see the movie, and I loved the way he looked, I loved the way he sang, I loved the way he wrote songs and played the piano, and then he started making his own records with the Asylum Choir, and then as Leon Russell and the Shelter People. And he was the person I wanted to make records like. So it brought back a lot of memories, very nostalgic, very sentimental. And I was kind of angry because I thought, you know, this man's been forgotten about. And he not only was the musician that everyone wanted to play on their records, but he was the band leader to go to, and he wrote the most beautiful songs that were hits, not only for himself, but for other people. So I just thought there had been an injustice, and I thought, you know, you haven't spoken to this guy for so long, you need to call him up. And so I phoned New York, got a number for Leon in Nashville, and called him up.
And you said?
I said, Lord, I'm here watching As the World Turns, and I've got a phone call from you. Haven't talked to you in 30 years.
I haven't talked to me in 38 years, actually. And we had a kind of awkward conversation. I mean, it's very hard when you don't speak to someone for 30 years. I'm not very good on the phone, and he's not great on the phone. But it was a nice conversation. I said, listen, I'm really sorry that I haven't been in contact, but I've been listening to this stuff. I told him the exact story, and I said, I really would love to have dinner with you when I come to America. I promise you we must get together. And I put the phone down after talking to him, and he'd seen the Spectacle show, and he said, oh, thanks very much for the Spectacle thing, and bless your heart, which he says a lot, bless him. And then I put the phone down, and I said, there's a reason that I'm getting in touch with Leon Russell. It's not, you know, it's a series of events, from Spectacle to me crying to me phoning him up. There's a message. It doesn't end here. And I phoned Johnny Barbas back, my manager in New York, and said, I need a number for T-Bone Burnett, who is one of my favorite producers, who I'd never spoken to in my entire life, happened to be in Nashville recording. I phoned him up, and I told him the story of breaking down and crying and listening to Leon's music. I said, you know, I know you've done Alison Krauss and Robert Plant. Would you ever be interested in doing a Leon Elton record? And he said, you know, I'd love to. He said, I'm a huge Leon Russell fan. And so he more or less tentatively agreed to do it. And I went, wow. So then I phoned him up back immediately, and I said, listen, you don't hear from me for 38 years. You get two phone calls in 40 minutes. What do you think about doing a record together? And he said, well, do you think I can? And I said, of course you can. I mean, you're still playing. You're still doing shows. And that's when I first called him up. I said, what have you been doing? He said, I've been, you know, touring, you know, in my bus and doing shows. And the thing that astounded me throughout this whole thing, you know, he was never bitter about, you know, falling out of the spotlight, because Leon as I've learned, was never really a spotlight person, although he looked amazing, had the most incredible image with the long hair and the Ray-Bans and the top hat and the way he played. And so we went into the studio in LA and thought, right, is this going to work? Can we write together? Can we play together? Can we sing together? I don't know. We used to on stage, but not as on a record. You know, two piano players sometimes would clash, but we didn't. We come from, we're built from the same cloth. He's the master, I'm the pupil. And it worked, and it sounded great, and he sang great. And we knew ahead of time that we had something special.
And your voices sound so great together, too.
They do. I mean, he's got, you know, that classic gravelly kind of song for you voice, and it's got even, you know, so, you know, I'd love to have a voice like that. But actually, there are some songs where we sound very, very similar, and he sounds like Willie Nelson a lot on some of the songs, I think. And
Get out of here.
You do. you do. On I tell you, on The Best Part of the Day, you sound like Willie.
There's a canyon where like the ancient bell of Notre Dame. It's beyond the hills, out of sight. Thought I heard them ringing all last night. Hear the mating call of the morning dove, like Romeo ain't in the roof above. Rain will come sweet and clean. Let the tears of God keep the mountains green.
Roll back the covers, raise the shade.
To hear you, Elton, say, oh, I wish I had a voice like that. I mean, your voice has done you pretty well.
Yeah, and I think it's getting better. I think I'm singing better now in my 60s than I did. Early on, you know, I had a very high voice and very full set of voice. I sound a bit like a castrato on some of the early records. My voice is like a little choir boy. And, you know, when I play live, I get a lot of reviews and the critics say, oh, well, you can't reach the high notes anymore. But I've said this time and time again, had an operation on my voice in Australia in the late 1980s. And it changed the timbre of my voice. I lost my falsetto to a certain extent, most of it. And it gave me a lower voice. And I'd rather sing the way I do now than the way I sang then. And I enjoy singing much more now. But you know, you put a Leon Russell record on or a Nina Simone record, and you know, or a Dylan record, and you know who's singing straight away. And that's what I'm saying. They've got that wonderful voice. There's always something that you wish you had that you don't have. And I'm glad about that, because if you didn't have someone to attain to, or, you know, pertain to, or, you know, idolize, then it wouldn't be fun.
It'd be all over in a way. Yeah. Leon Russell and Elton John are with us today on the World Cafe, and we're talking about their new album together called Union. Now, Leon, you have the opening track and the last track on the CD. And the last track, talk about that, because you wrote that for Elton.
Well, I did. I was actually in bed. I was speaking to my wife, and I said, you know, I want to give Elton something. He's given me so much. I want to give him something. And what do you give a guy that's got, I mean, really got everything, and he's hard to shop for, you know? And so I said, I'll give him a song, and I explained it to my wife, and actually the lyrics were rolling out, and I said, well, you better give me my computer. I appear to be writing the song right now. So I wrote the words, and then when we got in the studio, I was very anxious to see what the melody was going to sound like, so I wanted to get in there to an instrument and sing it.
Well, I could have been sick, I could have died, I could have given up and I tried to make it to tomorrow like a broken hearted lover, but there was a brand new start. Suddenly pecan. News in faraway places, and the music I was shaking.
Did you cry?
All cried. I remember it's all on the documentary film that Cameron Crowe's made. He captured that moment. T-Bone, Bernie Taupin, Johnny Bowers, myself, everybody in the studio. We knew what the song was about. It was pretty easy to understand. And I cried, and I went outside and dried my eyes and came back in again, and then I cried again. And you realize how Leon had a 5.5 hour operation on his brain. A week before the Grammys, and he was on the Grammys, and he did the music Cares, and he was very, very weak. I mean, you know, but he was so amazingly strong because he so wanted to do this stuff, and he got better and better and better during the album. He got more healthier, he could remember more things, because I think a lot of people came down, like Ringo and Stevie Nicks, Sharon Stone, Grace Jones, Jeff Bridges, Leanne Rimes. There was a lot of people came down to pay tribute to him. Paul McCartney sent a message. And I think that love is a great healer. With the atmosphere and the people on the record who, you know, really showed him the respect that he deserved, made him stronger physically and emotionally. And I've seen him come from that place in January 2010 to where he is now, where he can remember so much more. And he seems, you know, nothing like love and a bit of success. And, you know, he's now a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's going to be a member of the Songwriters Hall of Fame. That's what I wanted for him when I started this project. That was my ambition, was for him to get back into the ether of the music business and for people to give him his due.
So what was that night like for you recently when Elton was the one who presented you at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with your induction?
Well, I mean, speaking of crying, I've been pretty much crying ever since I got here.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to tell the story sometimes without crying. It was an exciting thing. I mean, I didn't think that I would be in that club for some reason. So it was exciting, and then I got a chance to explain my appreciation to Elton with his bag of PR and happiness that he brought to me.
Leon Russell and Elton John are with us today on the World Cafe, and we're talking about their new album together called Union. Some songwriters say that the experience is like channeling something, that they feel like a conduit for the music or the lyrics. Is that how either of you feel?
Definitely with me. I have no idea what I'm going to write until I see the printed page. When I see a lyric, either Leon's or Bernie's, I know what I'm going to write. And then I just look at it and I know what kind of song it is because the words are so poetic. And I just go from there. I don't make up melodies in my bed at night. I don't go around thinking, oh, I must. I've never written a melody down that I've thought of. I just leave it till that time and trust in the process. And I've never questioned the process. It's really spooky how it happens, but I trust in it. I have faith. Maybe someone's, you know, I just have faith in that process. And Leon's still writing songs. I'm still writing songs. And I don't think we've ever had, either of us have had blocks, songwriting blocks. You know, some songs are better than others, but they're all your little babies. And, you know, when you first write them, that's the most precious, I think, sometimes they sound.
Well, actually, I had blocks for years. I had studios in my house for 40 years. And I'd go sit in the studios and wait for inspiration, sometimes a year. We talk about blocks. And then I said, you know, I got to research this stuff. This is not right. This is wasting my time and money. So I was reading songs about how to write the popular, I mean, reading books, how to write the popular song and those kind of things. And one of the first things I read is, in the work of every prose artist, you'll find a failed poet. Poetry is harder to write than prose. Well, I was glad to know that. I'd never written any prose, really. But then I found out how to do it, and I could pretty much do it like an accountant. I go to work, and I can do it, you know. It's a good feeling. I'm not so apprehensive about the blank page anymore.
Well, and for example, on A Dream Come True, I had the chord sequence, and then he wrote the lyrics while I was writing the thing. I mean, it was just on this computer. I went, "How do you do that?" And he said, "It's easy." I remember you saying it. It's easy. I can teach you. Yeah. Because I don't write lyrics at all.
Well, maybe you'll learn now from him.
Oh, I don't know.
Proud of saying he doesn't know how to operate iPods and computers and stuff for that. It's kind of the same way with lyrics.
There's Only Tomorrow. Love that song. It's about living in the moment, which some people say is what makes you immortal. And it's funny the way your perspective changes on that, because when you're young, that's a justification for doing anything you want and being as self-destructive as you want. But then, as you get older, it seems to be more a rationale for really taking care of yourself.
Absolutely. And that song came about, I think, through Leon's, Hymn Number 5 by the Mighty Hannibal. And we stole the chorus. Well, we didn't steal it because we gave him the money, but Leon wrote the lyrics to the verse. And I wrote the melody, and we came up with this. It's a great song. It's a very stirring song. It reminds me of a New Orleans funeral. But yes, it is. You change your perspective on life all the time when you get older. The things that I loved to do when I was younger, I would hate to do now. I would hate to go to a disco. I would hate to stay up all night. I would hate to, to drink. My life is totally different. It's about different things. And it is about looking after yourself, or trying to look after yourself, and wanting to be around. You want to stay around and still write music. And I've just got a son recently, so that gave me another reason to live. That's why I do so many different things. I always wanted to have some more energy coming in, to keep me going. And music's always done that. I mean, if there's music, then I'll always have energy. But that song is such a beautiful, rousing chorus, and that was Leon's idea totally.
There's no time for waiting, no future to see. Inside the next moment, nothing might be. The answer's not certain, no time to decide. Is this the last curtain? There's no place to hide. There's no tomorrow. There's no tomorrow. There's no tomorrow.
Leon Russell and Elton John are with us today on the World Cafe, and we're talking about their new album together called Union.
Well, I think, if I may say this, that Elton has become spiritually correct in his old age. And back in the young days, he was working so hard and putting on such a show and doing all that stuff. But today, I think it's more far-reaching and long-lasting what he does, what he looks to do. He got bad press, I think, in the early days for some of that drug stuff. And
I think, some of the drug. Of course, you get. I didn't really get bad press until I admitted it. I mean, it affected what I wrote, and if you admit that you're a drug addict and everything, it's great for you. And I went and got clean, and I kept clean. But it was the most important thing. It was great for me. It wasn't when you get clean, you're not doing it for anybody else. You're doing it for yourself. And when I did that. I grew up, basically. Your priorities in life change. It's not all about you. It's about other people. I was then lucky enough to meet someone who I've been with for nearly 18 years. Your path becomes clearer because you're doing good things. Things fell into my lap, like The Lion King, which helped me do different things other than make music and records and videos and tour.
Starting your foundation.
Starting the AIDS Foundation because it was a miracle that I wasn't infected when I was doing drugs. So, I'm not particularly religious, but somebody has guided me in my life. And I do believe, I have a faith that I'm doing something right and that I should be doing something right. And that person or whatever fate, whatever sign it is or whatever power it is that's doing it has given me those signs. And luckily enough, I've always had the good fortune to follow them. It's like the little boy in the Ukraine when I wanted to adopt him, and he was he was the reason that when we couldn't adopt him, that I now have a child. And I never thought about having a child before. I thought, no, I can't have a child before. I'm too self-obsessed. I tour too much. It would be wrong to have a child. And that, you know, that little sign of that little boy jumping on my lap, and I suddenly thought, when we couldn't adopt him, I said, we should still go forward with this, because that boy was a sign from someone to say, you should do this. And
why couldn't you adopt him?
Legally, it's the red tape. I was too old in the Ukraine. Same-sex couples aren't recognized. We could have gone to the European Court of Law, but you know what? The child would still be in the orphanage during this time. Our priority was to get him out, which he is now out with his brother and in the hands of someone, his grandmother. And we sat down and said, listen, the person who is suffering is the child, and nobody is the pawn in the game. And it was a big story, but the last person being thought about was the child. And David and I said, we've got to give this up. We do look after the child. We have a lawyer in Ukraine permanently on the payroll to make sure he's looked after, and he's with his grandmother and his grandfather. They're not in the best of health, but at least he's out of the orphanage and getting tactile love with his brother. And that's all we wanted. And that sign with him sitting on my lap and just coming, gravitating towards me, was a sign from somewhere that I should maybe consider being a father and giving someone a life. And I took that sign, and I've always had the courage to do that. And little signs like that have come along every 3 or 4 years, 5 years, and they've guided me, and it's given me a lot more faith than I had when I was younger. I'm not religious, but I have faith, and I believe in Jesus Christ, and I believe in the good that if you're going to model yourself on somebody, that's not a bad person to model yourself on.
I know you were very friendly with Ryan White, the young AIDS activist who died. Was it his death that impelled you to go off drugs and start this whole process?
Yes, I would think, you know, meeting his family, realizing how out of whack I was, how, as a human being, I'd fallen into the absolute stench of the gutter as far as my behavior goes and my priorities. Being around his family, his mother, his sister, around the time of his, you know, being sort of bullied and having to move, and then of course his the last week of his death, where I was in Indianapolis, I learned a lot about people with real Christian values, not, you know, the fundamentalist people who think they're Christian. These people forgave people, and I find that is so touching. The things that they've been through, to lose a child, to have that hatred come toward you, and then have the ability to forgive. And I was 6 months later, I was sober. And it was also my partner at the time had also gone into treatment, which I was extremely angry about. And I think the mixture of the two shoved me in there. But it was definitely more the Ryan White thing than anything else. I realized what a nightmare I'd become, or how my life was totally and utterly devoid of anything that was humble or any humility whatsoever. So, yeah, and I'm still in touch with Gina. I played at the 20th anniversary of Ryan's death last year in Indianapolis. It was a big moment for me. I just went, the reason I got hold of the White family, I went to a dentist, doctor's waiting room in New York, and I picked up a Newsweek and I read about it, and I became so enraged about what was happening to this family, I got in touch with them. And so I seized the initiative and did something, and that was a sign. And because I got in touch with them, it got me to where I am now. And, you know, it's they're incredible people. I don't think I've met incredible people like that in my life. Matthew Shepard's mother, Jeannie Shepard, is another one. And I'm doing something for her again in about 2 weeks. You have to remember where you come from, how fortunate you are. And I came from a very simple background. A lot of things happened to me that were fantastic. But I didn't have the ability to handle myself off stage. I could be fine on stage, I was safe, but off stage, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to behave. I wanted to be part of the scene, but I was still basically that little boy who'd become famous, and I hadn't grown up. I started growing up when I was 43. That was the first time in my life, I think, I started to actually do things and become an adult. And, you know, do I have any regrets about that? Sure, I hurt a lot of people in the way, but you can't sit here moaning about the past. It's where I am now is one of the nicest places to be in the world. I put a lot of work into it, but you get the rewards from that. And I certainly, if I'd have carried on what I was doing when I knew the White family, I wouldn't be here talking to you. I'd be, you know, 6 feet under. So that little boy saved my life.
You also were a role model for a whole lot of other people who came after you. I'm thinking now of of gay artists, and I'm thinking of Lady Gaga and her flamboyance. Hopefully she credits you as an influence and in having paved the way.
She's like the bastard daughter of Elton John, yeah. And I know her very well. Lady Gaga is godmother to my son, and I love her. She's a very simple girl from New York. Yeah, she's wild on stage, and she's, you know, she's out there. But at the basis of it, her parents are very close to her. Her family life is very close to her. And I, you know, I keep an eye on her because, you know, it's not easy being a lady and a woman out there. And, you know, it can be a rough business to be in. Madonna was the first person to come around and actually make a statement for women saying, I'm going to take you guys on. And if it hadn't been for Madonna, there wouldn't be a Gaga. And I'm very fond of her. I love new artists. I get a lot of energy from them. I get energy from the young, not just musicians, painters, photographers, writers. If you dismiss the young, if you dismiss the old, you're foolish. If you dismiss the young, you're foolish too, because they have that energy that we used to have. I still have energy, but there's a certain kind of energy, and it's called adrenaline. And the young have it in spades, and they're fearless. And I love that quality about them. And sometimes they're fearless and they make mistakes, but they do it because they are fearless. They're not doing it. And I was the same when I was 23 to about 28. At those 5 years of invincibility that I had, I was fearless. And then I had to get a house, and then it became, you know, it was, I'm not saying the rot set in, but, you know, your life, you had to, all I thought about for 5 years was music, and it was great. And then I had to think about other things like paying tax and having a house and who's going to look after it. And I wasn't very good at things like that.
Leon, what has your trajectory been like in terms of what Elton was saying about, you know, getting this fame and being fine on stage, but then having difficulty off stage? Did you experience that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I was out of my alcoholic program about the time I was 18. I started early and I was able to be over with that stuff, but it's hard, you know. You get that kind of input. I didn't like the press, so consequently, that's why I ended up sort of under the radar. I didn't understand it. I didn't like to do that, and so.
He was not a self-publicist, you know, publicist.
No.
And you know, the business changed so much from the 70s to the 80s, and then we got to the digital age, and, you know, it's hard to keep up sometimes. And I think, just to finalize, you know, what we've been talking about, I think a lot of artists, creative artists, whether they're writers, again, any form of the performing arts or the creative arts, are very self-destructive. We do what we do to get attention for some reason or other. I know I did it to prove something to my dad that I could do what he said I couldn't do. But it's a very self-destructive business if you're not careful.
Thank you so much, Leon Russell, Elton John, for being with us on the World Cafe. Congratulations on the wonderful album, and here's to whatever's next.
Thank you very much.
Elton John and Leon Russell, and our thanks to Michaela Majune. Their new album together is called The Union.